And so here's number seven. Write a book. Write a book. If we'd been doing this conference last week, it would have worked out really well, because last week was the anniversary of Johannes Gutenberg's invention of the printing press. I had a chance to go to Germany not too long ago and actually went to the Gutenberg Museum. Got to see some of those early presses, those early Bibles, things of that nature. But let's talk about writing a book. Earlier, I talked about how books can influence you. And I talked about, I remember where I was sitting in 1995 when I read this one book and how it dramatically influenced me. I could talk about other books. I remember where I was when I read Oswald Sanders' book on spiritual leadership and how that influenced me. I mean, my salvation was influenced by a book in 1989 when I read Peace with God by Billy Graham. We all can point to books that have influenced each of us, but have you ever considered how your writing a book could influence others? So let me tell you a little bit about my writing journey, and most of this will not surprise you if you've been paying attention just to the first part of this teaching. First of all, you should know that I've struggled with the English language my entire life. That is no surprise to you. I've dangled participles, I've mixed verbs and adverbs all morning long. It is a constant struggle. I did not have a solid foundation in English. I work at it. If you think it's bad now, you should have heard me a few years ago. But I've struggled with it all of my life, partly because I happened to be in a school district as a kid that was all about science and math. So we were doing STEM in my school district as a kid before it was cool. So we didn't focus a lot on English and writing. But also, I had a speech impediment as a kid. And so this speaking thingy wasn't something I was interested in. And I was naturally geared to kind of being a math person. Numbers made sense to me. Words didn't. I still cannot diagram a sentence to this very day. In fact, I was a pretty good student, but the only C's I ever made were in English. But I remember one particular devastating year was in ninth grade, because in ninth grade I got serious about it and said I'm going to work really hard, and I really tried, and I wanted to get a B minus, and I got a C. And I'm still bitter against the lady whose name I can remember, and if she's listening to this, her name is Mrs. Ann Robbins. I'll tell you a story about Ann Robbins in a minute. My parents retired, moved to sort of their retirement home. They've been retired for 15, 20 years. They retired, moved to a retirement home, and they live beside, this is no kidding, they live beside Mrs. Ann Robbins. My dad fishes with her husband. Every time I write a book, I send two copies to my dad. One copy for him, one copy to give to his fishing buddy's wife. I have this image that she has this bookshelf of my books, and I've resisted the temptation in every one to inscribe it, "How many books have you written?" But I digress. Isn't that strange? Isn't that strange how things work? You know. What would be the chances of that? God has a sense of humor, I suppose. But not only did I struggle with writing, my bigger issue before I went in ministry was I struggled with reading. And this may be a piece of the puzzle you don't know. But when I went in ministry in 1990, it would have been difficult for me to name two or three books that I'd read in entirety. And so maybe that's more why I made C's in English, because I wouldn't read Shakespeare, or I wouldn't read. My wife all the time asked me, "Did you read that in high school?" I didn't read it in high school. You know, 1984, nope, I was going to high school in 1984. I didn't read anything in that. But when I went in ministry, I did ask God to give me a passion for reading. And I said, "God, if I'm going to be able to do this thing in ministry, the big gap in my ability is I've got to be a reader. You know, we're people of the book. I got to be able to read the Bible." And it wasn't that I couldn't read. I just chose not to read, which is almost as bad as a person who can't read. But by God's grace, since 1990, I've been a voracious reader. God has answered my prayer. In fact, my wife Kelly and I, were taking some books from our home to a little overflow storage room that I rent to keep my books in, and she said, maybe you should stop praying that prayer about being a voracious reader. But the truth is, I wouldn't be here with you if God had not answered that prayer. But this little section isn't about reading more. I have an entire seminar on that. This is about kind of the result of that. So 1990, I prayed, God, help me start reading. Give me a passion for reading. 15 years later, I'm at my office in New York City, and out of the blue, a literary agent shows up. Now, our office at that time was on 35th Street by the Javits Center. This is not like they just, you know, ambled in because they meant to go to McGraw-Hill in Midtown. No, I mean, they made a trek, and it was a trek over to our office because we had to go where it was cheap. This literary agent said, have you ever thought about writing? We follow the Journey Church. We've seen some of the press. You ought to consider it. I said, what's a literary agent? What's this thing you mean about writing? And graciously exited her pretty quickly. The next day, a publisher that was in town from a well-known Christian publisher made their trek over to our 35th Street office, showed up for an impromptu meeting, to which I said to my assistant, can we not schedule appointments? Never mind. And I had an impromptu meeting with a publisher. Not my kind of publisher. What they were wanting me to do was not even something that I was interested in. But a week later, another publisher showed up, this time scheduling a meeting with me, bringing full guns into this meeting. And it was what eventually became my first publisher, Regal. And I was interested in what they had to say. And they wanted to do a book on church planting. I wanted to write a book on assimilation. I told them I would do the assimilation book if they would publish my I would do the church planting book if they would publish the assimilation book. And we had a great conversation, but I was scared to death. But I did think after those three things happened in a series of a few weeks, okay, God, I get the idea. But once again, I said, I need some help. I mean, you know, I don't know how to do this. I'm not sure about it. And within a month, God sent me my first partner in writing. Because I could create content, I could write, but I needed help. I needed someone who could smooth it out. I needed someone who could strengthen it. I needed someone to help me with things I don't like about writing, such as footnotes. I hate them. I hate footnotes. So I don't have footnotes. I don't know why my publisher wants me to put footnotes. Isn't it just enough that I say it? It should be true because of the ex cathedral authority of the author. But no, they want me to back things up, you know? I mean, it ought to be enough that I say, Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses on October 31st, 1517, but they actually want me to, like, footnote it. I hate that. So I have someone who helps me with that. You know, I sort of butcher the English language, as you've noticed. I have someone who helps me with that. And so, I mean, I remember that day, you know, when Jennifer Henson walked into my office and said, you know, I used to work for Charles Stanley. I've been going to the Journey. I just wanted to come in and meet you. And I thought, oh, goodness. I wonder what's going on here. And I've had other people over the years, but Jen and I have had a good relationship where I send her my stuff and she sends it back to me at 3 a.m. in the morning and I don't care. And we've written some books together. But God sent me what was needed when I was ready. He taught me how to read so I could read for 15 years so I could get a handle on how to write. And then now I've been writing for almost that long, not quite, but almost that long. But I remember in that first meeting with Regal, a guy I'm still friends with today, he asked me if I'd be interested in writing a book. And I told him that I would only be interested in writing books because books can go where I can't go. Because remember, I'm like this introverted guy. Sit in my little coaching room, do coaching, Spurgeon on the wall. You know, I can write books now. Books go to all these places I could go. And that's been true. Books can go where I can't. They can go even where I won't go or be able to go. And that's been my publishing story. I am calculating for some other project we're working on how many books I have in print, but it's hundreds of thousands, actually. Hundreds of thousands of books in print. Generosity Ladder itself is pushing like 200,000 copies in print. And these books have increased my influence beyond anything I can imagine. And my guess is that they've influenced you in some way or another. In fact, my best coaching person is someone who started with the books. because if you're not a reader, you're not going to like my coaching networks very much. That's probably why a lot of you are here now, and we have record attendance at this event. On a related note, however, if you think about it, I would venture that if you made a list of the people who have influenced you in your ministry, 9 out of 10 of them have written books. So why not you? Why not you? I mean, I've got all the excuses in the world. Speech impediment, seasoned English, never really read many books, butcher the English language. I didn't have everything I needed to write a book on that week when those publishers showed up, but it's been gathered along the way. God sent me people. God sent me writers. Now, because of the way the CLI staff is organized, there's multiple writers, you know, that take little things that I write and create, you know, amazing stuff that they do. I still have to do this. I wish, you know, we could create people to do this so I could just stay up in the room, but I still have to, like, come down here and do this. But, you know, for some of you, you need to really consider this. Now, here's what you don't know about my writing story. I've written a lot more books than you are even aware of. Some of them stay on my computer and never go anywhere. But I write also books just for the Journey Church, for my congregation. And you don't even see these. I mean, every once in a while, somebody will come to the church, get one, and it shows up on Amazon. I go quickly buy it, you know, to get it off of there. But you don't even know they exist. You won't ever see them in bookstores. And so maybe you've never thought, well, I want to be in a bookstore, I want to be on Amazon, but what about writing a book just to deepen your influence with your congregation? You know, none of us are ever going to write a book that's read by millions of people. I mean, maybe you will, but I mean, generally speaking, the odds are against that. You know, that first literary agent, by the way, I was fairly convinced they showed up at my door because they knew of my affiliation with a guy who had written the best-selling book in English history. You know that book? It sold 40 million copies. And I'm like, if I could write that book, I wouldn't need a literary agent. But, you know, they thought maybe on my website, because I had an affiliation with them, they were looking for that next book. Yeah, I am too, but, you know. But, I mean, to write a book that's read by 500 people, to write a book that's led by 1,000 people, I mean, how much effort would you go to if you could give a seminar to 500 people, if you could give a seminar to 250 people? And then, you know, for it to be with them and impact them. And so the early church leaders that we all look up to, they were primarily writing books for their congregation. I mean, that was their audience. And so there's only so much you can do on a Sunday, so now you have impact in your congregation. And I love it when my people give away my books to, you know, people who are not yet in the church. They use it as invite tools. I mean, it's a very time-intensive invite tool to give one of my books to somebody else. But once I wrote it, it's there for a long time. So maybe you've thought about that. I've had, you know, people go through my Write Your First Book workshops, and they decided to write a book just for their family. You know, it's just a gift they want to give the people they love most. Or perhaps you do have that big ministry idea that the kingdom needs to hear. And there really is no better way to organize your thoughts, to finesse your ideas, to nuance it in a way that people can use than to put it in a book. Because there's something happens when an idea goes from your head through your body and out through your fingertips. It's clarifying. I've had great ideas in my head that just are almost incomprehensible when I write them out. And so we all know they weren't really that great in my head, but I thought they were. And so in recent days, I've become more vocal about pushing my coaching networks to write a book. I was pushing advanced coaching this week. I wanted every one of them to write a book. I would love to see all of my coaching folks write a book. Now, to write a book, you need a system. And I have one that is unsustainable. I have a book system that I teach that is sustainable, but the part of the formula that I don't give you is my formula for writing the book goes something like this. Massive input from books that I read, plus hundreds of hours with my coaching networks, equals one 250-page book. It's as simple as that. That's my formula. Now, beyond that, I have developed systems. I've developed a system to turn a sermon series into a book. In fact, some of my most influential books are actually sermon series. The Generosity Ladder, that's not a sermon series, that was a sermon. And then to have a formula. You can't just take your sermon notes and suddenly turn it into a book, because a sermon is not a book. You know, this lecture that I'm giving to you is not a book. But you can develop a system, and you can decide to do some things before you deliver the sermon so that you set it up to make it easier to turn into a book. And that's the kind of stuff I can teach you. That's the kind of stuff I can show you. Beyond that, all of my regular ministry books have all been coaching lectures before. You know, I lecture for 2, 3, 4 days, and then out of that, you know, we get this book. And so you'll need a system to do this, but it is an influence multiplier. And it is a way for you to dramatically expand and multiply your influence. So think about that. Consider that. Don't say no to it. And don't listen to all the excuses that you have in your own head, some of those critics that you associate with. You know, your mother-in-law, Mrs. Robbins. She goes to church with my parents now. That kills me. But I'll see her one day. In Zion, we will meet. No, I've actually, all kidding aside, I've actually had some great conversations with them and gone fishing with her husband when I go up to see my dad. Had some conversations. She didn't remember it. She didn't remember it all. She's let it go. I've been holding this root of bitterness for years, and she hasn't thought about me one single time. All the time she thinks about me, she calls over to my parents' house. Oh, is Nelson in town? Yeah, I'm like, okay, no, it's not as bad. I'm just having a little fun with it. But I did try really hard that year. Still made a C. So I probably would today if I had to go back through her class, actually. Number 8, resist complacency. I know I said these were going to be all positive, but I had to at least do this one. I know it's the negative. Resist complacency. One of my favorite quotes about Christian ministry comes from a guy that I'm not even sure he was a Christian. His name is Earl Nightingale. He often talked about Christian things, but I cannot personally testify to his faith. Earl Nightingale, who taught about success and about leadership for about 30 years in America before he passed, he said something very profound one time when he simply said, quote, "The opposite of success is not failure, but complacency." And Earl said it in a voice that sounded like God. "The opposite of success is not failure, but complacency." I tried smoking cigars for about 3 years to see if I could get that voice. All I got was laryngitis. So I'll just stick with mine. But complacency, the opposite of success is not failure, but complacency. I might want to finesse that a little bit and say something like, between success on the way to failure, there is the acceptance of complacency. But nonetheless, complacency is a big issue. My publisher tells me I should never quote a definition, but the definition of complacency is this: a feeling of smug or uncritical satisfaction with oneself or one's achievements. That's actually what Webster defines as complacency: a feeling of smug or uncritical satisfaction with oneself or one's achievements. And so I've noticed this in certain pastors that I've worked with. They do fall into sort of this smug satisfaction about where they are. And oftentimes, forgive me for perhaps being a little critical, oftentimes it is an acceptance of average or worse. And so we get to this point sometimes where we begin to embrace average. We begin to be smug about average. We begin to be complacent about average. And that is a disease, I think, in ministry, because there's always going to be somebody that you're doing better than. There's always going to be someone that you're baptizing more or having more people or whatever, but we have to be careful with this. So my favorite word for complacency is slack. It's kind of a phrase that I just kind of like saying, slack. But what happens is when you embrace complacency, you allow for slack inside your ministry. Complacency is problematic because it comes in slowly. It comes in almost undetectably. It comes in unnoticeable. And it's kind of like a gas leak. You know, oftentimes you don't realize it's even there until it's too late. It's the problem I teach about attendance is that the average church in America is declining by 9% a year. I think the devil has worked out the numbers that 9% is just enough that you don't notice it until it's too late. So, you know, you're pastoring this church of 100 and over a year it declines to 91. That's 9%. You think, well, that's not that bad. 91, I can think of a few families that, you know, left the church, a key matriarch or patriarch that passed away. So there's reasons why you're down to 91. Then the next year, you know, you fall down to 83 or 82. You think, oh, we had a tough year. You know, economy, you know, political season. Yeah, I was out sick, whatever. The next year, however, you know, you're down to 74. And now all of a sudden you like have this wake-up call that 3 years into this you're down to 74. But the problem is the seeds of your destruction have already been sown. And now it's too late. It's much harder to turn that three-year decline around. So it's almost like the devil is so crafty that he realizes, you know, if I cut the church in half, everybody would get real serious all of a sudden and start paying attention. So he's just going to kill us slowly. And that kind of becomes the way it works. And that's how complacency works. Complacency creeps into your health very slowly. You know, it's not like you go to bed one night and, you know, you're fit and then you wake up the next morning and you're fat. You know, it doesn't happen like that. You know, it's like you go out and eat one Big Mac and then all of a sudden like your cholesterol is through the roof. You know, it's slow. And so this slack thing is so interesting to me that complacency creeps into your health and you get slack about your diet and you get slack about your exercise. Complacency, you know, creeps into your spiritual life and you just slack off a little bit in your prayer time or in your Bible study. Complacency creeps into your ministry like a gas leak and you get slack about your personal growth or about your association with the right people. Complacency creeps into your church and you get slack about church systems and you're not following up with every first-time guest this week. And I teach this little equation in my coaching network that slack equals lack. And I kind of love that wordplay because wherever you find slack, you will find lack. Because if you're slack in your health, there will be lack in your energy. If you're slack in your sermon preparation, there will be lack in your preaching. If you're slack with your assimilation efforts, you will lack when it comes to first-time guests. And we could go on and on. Slack equals lack. But the paradox of complacency, and I think the good news, if there is anything about complacency, if Mrs. Robbins could see my notes and see how I spell complacency three different ways in the course of this page, she would give me another C. I just look down and I'm like, complacency, N-C-I. And I'm like, I spelled that three different ways over two pages here. We all blame that now, right, on autofill. You know, or what was it called? Autocorrect? You know, on our phones, we send something that's like auto-corrects. I was sending something the other day, and I said, we'll meet day after tomorrow. I meant to say, we'll meet day after tomorrow. Autofill changed day to death. So we'll meet death after tomorrow. And I thought to myself, I wonder how many times I've written death, like over the last year, that it's been added to like the autofill vocabulary. Or, you know, was I like so far off on day that day became DEA or something like that, you know? And sometimes I find, you know, that funny, like how these things work. I'm sure there's like memes out there on social media of, you know, autofill that has really screwed things up, but you're giving up social media. So, but here's the paradox of complacency. Complacency The paradox is this: it's easy to fix if you catch it early. It's hard to fix if you catch it late. It's a paradox. Catch it late, it's very, very difficult to fix. 3 years into a church decline, 4 years in, 5 years in, it's hard to catch. 4 years into bad habits, it's hard to catch. Now, you still got to fix it, but it's easier to catch if you catch it early. So here's a few thoughts on how to catch complacency early. Actually, I spelled it right this time. How to catch complacency early. First of all, set high standards. Set high standards. Don't settle for anything less than best. How many first-time guests are you going to follow up on every week? All of them. All of them. That's going to be our standard. We're going to follow up on every first-time guest every week. Got to set high standards. How many days when you get up in the morning are you going to guzzle down a bottle of water? Every day. Every day. You know, I set it out now. You know, I set it out. In fact, in my little coaching cave, I have them deliver the number of bottles of water that I'm going to drink in the course of a month. And it's actually a lot cheaper than I thought. Like, I was going to do one of those bottle services. I use an office supply delivery company. And so, you know, about the 15th of every month, they show up with, like, these cases. And I know I should be more eco-friendly, and I should wash out the water bottle. And I've got, like, a gazillion of these old coaching water bottles that we send out. But there's something about the bottle and the crushing it. And then I recycle, so give me a break. I recycle. They come pick it up right outside my house every day. So, you know, I just have it delivered. And I can tell, like, if I get behind. So I'm here for 4 days. I got to drink, like, 4 bottles of water this weekend because I'm behind. So it's 2 bottles of water, you know, on next Sunday. But, you know, every day I'm going to do it. And I'm going to do it here. You know, before I go to bed tonight, I set the bottle of water in the bathroom sink. Because, you know, first thing I go into in the bathroom, you know, in the morning. And there it is. Every day. You got to figure out the things that are high standards in your life, and you're saying, I'm not going to allow any slack to sit in. I'm going to do it every day. Set high standards. Number two, focus on the little things that have big results. In most areas of your life and in all systems of your life, there are a number of little things that have big results. And if you're going to shortcut anything, or if you're running behind on something, don't cut that thing. In another lecture somewhere, I call these keystone habits. They're keystone habits. That was not original with me. There was a book a few years ago called The Power of Habit, and it taught me this term. So look, I would like to have and to be able to tell you that I have a long, engaging, spiritually refreshing devotion every single day of my life. And I do, because I'm more spiritual than you. But there are days when I don't. There are days when I'm under pressure. There are days when things don't go my way. But there are not days where I miss. And on those days where I have to shortcut it, if you will, still prayer and still a Bible verse. So if I don't do anything else, I'm going to at least say a prayer and I'm going to read a Bible verse. Now, honestly, it's not that many days that I have to shorten it that much. But, you know, I mean, I remember, you know, one the other morning, I should have had like a nice little time, you know, there. My wife had something that she was gone to. And all I had to do that morning was, you know, get up early and write, have my devotion, and take my son to school. That's all I had to do. Well, nosebleed. Nosebleed. My son had a nosebleed, you know, 6:15 in the morning. So I get the writing done, got the coffee on, going to have a little devotion. He doesn't get up till 7, nosebleed. So it's like I'm trying to think of a verse and pray for his nosebleed to stop as I'm trying to help him. Got sort of shortcutted. I picked it up a little bit more at lunch, but life happens, things happen. But you got to kind of say these are the minimums, the irreducible minimums of the little things. And so, you know, a little thing, that's a big result. So I'm always going to do the bottle of water. I'm always going to walk 30 minutes if at all possible. Little things. And then pursue diligence. This is a little different than set high standards, by the way. Pursue diligence means that you go the extra mile. You not only try to do everything that you say you're going to do, but you push yourself to do just a little bit more. It's the baker's dozen. You're only required to do a dozen, but let's see if we can't do one more. You know, I write, I'm a pretty fast writer, so this will surprise you. I write my 1,000 words. Maybe today I could push myself to do just one more paragraph. Maybe just a little more outlining. You know, just a little bit more. Not every day, not all the time, but you stretch yourself to do just a little bit more from time to time, just to overcompensate for the complacency that you know is going to set in. So my Sabbath is a bit like that. You know, most of the time I have a pretty set routine, I have a pretty good devotional time, but you know, on my Sabbath I take just a little more time. Just slow it down a little bit more. A little bit more time in Scripture, a little bit more time in the journal, a little bit more time. We're in a season right now where, you know, we're fasting. I don't fast all throughout the year. I've learned from Dr. Elmer Towns and others about the power of fasting at different times. But, you know, we're in a season of fasting. That's kind of, to me, like it kind of catches up the slack that may be there, or it's preventative for the future slack that I want to have. That's diligence. It's just going a little bit beyond, you know. So, yes, I could, you know, sort of, I've got enough calories to have this meal tonight, but, you know, I'm not that hungry. I'm feeling pretty full. Let's just go ahead and stop. That's that diligence thing. That's where you're going the extra mile, or in this case, not going the extra mile, to create the slack that, you know, is going to come tomorrow morning when we have chocolate with our spouses. So it just sort of works that way. But I can tell you, in coaching over 3,000 pastors, complacency is the disease that impacts pastors most. I said it in another seminar called Finish Well, that I have seen, having coached so many pastors, some pastors fall out of ministry because of the big three, money, sex, and power. But I've seen a lot more settle. I've seen a lot more fall into a feeling of smug or uncritical satisfaction with oneself or one achievement. And my limited association buddies that I have from college, not all of them, but some of them, they've just settled for average. And they built an entire repertoire, they built an entire system, if you will, that allows for complacency, embraces complacency, that in essence, they've fallen in love with complacency. My challenge to you is develop a holy discontent for the status quo. A holy discontent. You can talk to God about that in your devotion tomorrow. Develop a holy discontent for the status quo. Be diligent in your calling. Never settle. Resist, fight complacency with every tool that you can. And one of the ways that you do that is influencer number 9. And I think this will be helpful to you. Number 9 is to stay focused. Stay focused. I will do a quick review here. I won't go back all the way to number 1. I'll review from the break. When we came back from the break, number 5 was invest in leaders. Number 6 was leverage systems. Number 7 was write a book. You can get that done tonight. Just bring it with you tomorrow morning when you come down. Number 8 is resist complacency. And number 9 is to stay focused. These last two are really short, just in case you're wondering. Focus is an influence multiplier. It's also a very difficult thing to do. One of my early mentors used to say all the time, I can still hear him say it, I wish I could do impressions. I would do it the way he said it. But all the time, rarely did I hear him give a leadership talk to other pastors where he did not say in some form or another this phrase, light diffused has little power, but focused light can cut through steel. Isn't that a great phrase? Light diffused has little power. Now it has some power, you know. It's light in this room that is diffused light, But for those of us who are sitting directly under a light, I don't think we're really worried about the impact that's going to have on us. But now if we took that same wattage, do we use wattage anymore or is it lumens now? If you took that same wattage or lumens and you could focus it like a laser, that literally could cut through the table, cut through the chair, cut through the desk that we're sitting at. So it is in our lives that when we are unfocused, yes, we can do some things. Yes, we can have some impact. But when you can focus your life, there's real influence. There's real power. And I've noticed that complacency, to tie it back to number 8, is often the result of failure to focus. And so trying to do too many things, trying to diffuse your energy, trying to, doing too many things at once. Studies have shown, by the way, that it's impossible to multitask. It is. I used to pride myself on being a good multitasker. I was just really good at switching in between things fast. Now I've learned that's a bad way. Work one thing to completion, but that's another talk. Complacency is often the result of failure to focus. And then I would say an unfulfilled calling is often the result of the wrong focus. You can be pursuing your calling and get diffused because you're not focused, but then you can really miss out on your calling because you've got the wrong focus. But if you think about it, the most influential leaders, really not just in ministry, but in all areas of life, are focused leaders. Now, I've got 2 Buffett quotes before we leave, and I don't like to quote anybody twice. And I wish one of these was Jimmy Buffett, and I wish the other one was Warren Buffett, but it's not. They're both from Warren Buffett. And I have no idea of Warren Buffett's spiritual commitment, but I have 2 quotes, one now and one here in just a moment when we wrap up. One is not so much a quote, but it is something I learned from Warren Buffett, and I've heard him talk about several times, because whatever you think, he is focused, and he has done some amazing things in the financial world, and he said one time in explaining his success as an investor, he may be horrible to his kids, horrible to his wife, I don't know. I hope he's a believer and, all that. But he did say in defining his success as an investor that he had an unwavering ability to stay within his, and here's the phrase, circle of competence. I just love that phrase. He had an unwavering ability to stay within his circle of competence. Competence, not complacency, competence. C-O-M-P-E-T-E-N-C-E. Circle of competence. And so what he said is, in all the things that he could put his money in, there's only a handful of things that he really understands. And he only invests in things that he understands. And every time he's gotten into some kind of investment that was a little outside of his circle of competency, he's made a mistake. So I love this because he invests in Coca-Cola because he gets it. We drink it, you buy another one. It's a good thing, He invests in Dairy Queen because he gets it. He invests in railroads because he gets it. They move stuff from here to there along tracks. And he avoided getting involved in all the tech bubble that led to the first crash. And then he got, it wasn't any of those big mortgage things that led to the second crash that's happened over the last 10 years. And I just find that phrase really interesting. And it shouldn't be all that new to us because most of us know the old saying, the old soul, if you will, pun intended, he is a jack of all trades and a master of none. It's because there's no core competence. There's no circle of competence. And here's what I've observed, and I think you would agree with. The most influential leaders have mastered a few things. Just a few things. They've chosen to focus. And that's a challenge to you. My challenge to you, my suggestion to you, is to focus on just a few things. Not that many, a few. I am unable to do a few things well. Just ask my wife. I'm unable to do many things well, rather. I'm unable to do many things well. I can't do many things. I'm worthless. Like, I tried to change a light bulb, but I, like, the whole thing falls out. I mean, you know, we got like a high ceiling. We bought this thing. You're supposed to, like, you know, it's, you're supposed to reach up there, and it's an extension, and you're supposed to change it. So I finally get it in the light bulb. I unscrew the light bulb. I pull the light bulb down. Whole thing falls out. And I'm terrible at this. I'm not good at many things. But I've asked God to help me be good at a few things. And I've tried to be like Buffett in a way. Sometimes I'm more like Jimmy than Warren. But I've tried to be like Buffett in a way and say, okay, what is my circle of competency? And I'll just stay right here. I'm not going to get outside there. Every once in a while, somebody will come up to me at one of these seminars. When are you going to do a seminar on that? And I'm like, never. You know, Journey's not good at it. I'm not good at it. You know, I'm sure I've got coaching alumni who are good at it, but I'm not going to do one on that. I'm not good at it. It's not inside my competency. Now, you know, my competency happens to be, you know, in an area that I really love, and I love church, and I love pastors and all that, so I just stay right here. But I've tried to figure out in my life, and it does change a little bit over time, the three or four things that will be my focus. And I want to challenge you to do that too. What will be the three or four things that will be your focus in ministry? And of course, this ties back to your calling. When God calls you, He doesn't call you to do many things. He calls you to do just a few. What's going to be the focus of your life? From a professional standpoint, if you will, and I know I read the book too, we're not supposed to be professionals, but we are. From a professional standpoint, I mean, my focus is pastoring the Journey Church. I'm less hands-on today than I've ever been, but then in other ways, I'm more hands-on than I've ever been. It's just different. But I pastor the Journey Church. I serve as a coach to other pastors, and I write. And that's about the three things. And those may shift, those may change, one may replace another. We'll see. You know, 10, 15 years ago, I wasn't writing, so I'm willing to let them shift over time, but they don't shift every month, they don't shift every week, you know, they don't change every hour. And by the way, I've got stuff I'd love to write about, but it's not in my circle of competency. So until God releases me from one of these, like, I've got this whole idea about this thing that would lead me to travel and go up and down a certain portion of the United States, and I've got a whole book idea about it. And I kind of enjoy doing it. I'd like to do it. Not in my circle of competency. You know, under a different set of circumstances, you know, maybe something would happen with that. I don't know. But at least right now, it's like a fascination, but it's not a focus. And be careful about those things. You can get fascinated on something. You can be, you know, you get kind of a fanatical interest in something, but it may not be in your focus. And I actually think right now, if I turned down something in my area of focus and I went and did this other little thing that's sort of fascinating, I'd be miserable at it. Because I'm not in God's will, I'm not in my circle of competence. And by the way, if you don't like my phrase circle of competence, and you don't like Warren Buffett, just think of it as being in the center of God's will. If you're Pentecostal, you got to get under the spout where the glory comes out. And if you're not under the spout, the glory's coming out, but you're not getting any on you. And somebody else is getting it, and bless them, Lord, bless them. So that's it, just a few things. Now, do I do a few other things that are occasionally? Yeah, I do, but I don't like it. And, you know, you'd be surprised for me at, like, how many things I say no to. In fact, that's, if you don't know Scott's story, when Scott first came on staff, he was a coaching network member, pastor in a church. I'm not in the business of hiring people away from their church to come work for my ministry. But I said, hey, Scott, do you have enough time in leading your church that you could just tell people no for me? And he did so good, they never invite me again. He just told them no. But I say no to all kinds of conferences, all kinds of speaking things. My publisher has a wonderful plan for my life. I say no to that. Because I've learned a life diffused, is that what my mentor said? Life diffused has little power, but a focused life has great influence. Or maybe he said light diffused, but I think you get the point. What's your life focus? Is it focused enough? Are you trying to do too many things? And then, is it the right focus? Is there something that God wants to bring into focus right now in your life? Something that God wants to adjust? Give him permission to do that. Finally, finally, number 10. He didn't applaud, so he must be okay. So sometimes at the journey, I say, in conclusion, But what they don't know is I learned to preach from the Apostle Paul, so I say in conclusion 3 or 4 times. And finally, brothers, in conclusion, in my own handwriting, I write this final note to you. They don't know. So, number 10, finish well. Finish well. Even though I did not start with a joke or a story or a compelling insight, I did start with a parable. The parable of the talent, we often call it. But it should be called the parable of the steward, I believe. And that's the words that the steward heard. Well done. You finished well. Paul says it differently in a moment. We'll look at that. Finishing well means that you avoid the big tripwires, pitfalls that will keep you from finishing well. And another resource, I talked about money and sex and pride, even a little bit more on complacency, failure, things like that. You know, in order to finish well, you do have to avoid those landmines. But you also have to have a commitment to finish well. You have to have a long-term view. And again, not to quote Warren Buffett twice in 2 points, but I will. This is actually a quote from Warren Buffett. And he said this: it takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it. He then added, if you think about that, you'll do things differently. I couldn't have said it better. Wish I had said it. It takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it, I've always said. Because I heard Warren Buffett say it one time. So as leaders, we have to pursue influence multipliers. We have to also protect ourselves from things that would constrict, like a restrictor plate, constrict our influence. We have to certainly build hedges of protection against temptation, sexual temptation, financial temptation, whatever it might be. But we have to also have this long-term view, this overriding commitment, realizing that it's not about us, but it's about God's grace, it's about God's strength, it is about this great cloud of witnesses that we are surrounded by. It's about being around people that have the same commitment that we have, the commitment to finish well. And I say it just about at every talk that I give in a setting like this. Let's, you and I, by God's grace, make a commitment to be in ministry for the rest of our lives. And that's my prayer for you, that you would fulfill your calling, that you would finish well. And so I end with the words of 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 through 8. Paul talking to Timothy, but talking to us. I solemnly urge you in the presence of God in Christ Jesus, who will someday judge the living and the dead when he comes to set up his kingdom, preach the word. Be prepared whether the time is favorable or not. Patiently correct and rebuke and encourage your people with good teaching. I'm at 2 Timothy 4, verse 3. For a time is coming when people will no longer listen to sound and wholesome teaching. They will follow their own desires and look for will look for teachers who will tell them whatever their itching ears wish to hear. Verse 4. They will reject the truth and chase after myths. But you, and this is actually the key verse for our entire network, but you should keep a clear mind in every situation. Don't be afraid of suffering for the Lord. Work at telling others the good news and fully carry out the ministry God has given you. As for me, my life has already been poured out as an offering to God. The time of my death is near. Verse 7, you know it. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race and I have remained faithful. And now the prize awaits me, the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give me on the day of his return. And the prize is not just for me, but for all who eagerly look forward to his appearing. Even so, come Lord Jesus. Amen.